Greetings, friends and gentle listeners, and welcome to episode 27 of the Spicer Speaking Podcast, coming to you from sun-washed Palm Desert, California, in the heart and bosom of the Coachella Valley, your golf and sporting bounty. I'm your host, Judd Spicer, four-time award-winning writer, associate member of the Golf Writers Association of America, former ESPN radio co-host, and so on and so forth with the bona fides. Big week, special week here in SoCal and across the golf universe, to be sure. It's the 121st playing of the U.S. Open. Right down the way, San Diego, California, the Torrey Pines South Course. To acknowledge the big week, got a big episode. It is a primo double dip of guests, starting with legendary architect Rees Jones. Over the past 30-plus years, Rees has had a bigger hand in designing or modifying or remodeling. Courses played for the U.S. Opens, not to mention PGA Championships and Ryder Cups. Had a bigger hand than any other golf course designer by far. That list, of course, including, certainly not limited to, his extensive work, two-decade relationship with the Torrey Pines South Course. Really looking forward to that chat with Rees. Also joining the Spicer Speaking Podcast today, she is a longtime PGA professional here in SoCal. I think 30 years. We need to clarify that. Also a public speaker, a writer, fellow contributor, award-winning at that, to the SCGA's 4 magazine. Probably recognize her surname, Tina Mickelson. Also joining the Spicer Speaking Podcast. Again, great T-sheet of guests for a big week, which I think is going to make for a big episode of the show. Of course, none of this would be possible without a trio of dynamite sponsors. That list starts weekly with Perform Better at performbetter.com. All your gym, fitness, workout, seminar needs. I've had some friends, family, colleagues ask me about Perform Better, performbetter.com. I tell you what, next month we got the Olympics coming back, the Summer Olympics. You're going to probably hear a lot more about Perform Better, not just from this show, but from other media around the country, if not the world. So many of the athletes, namely the track and field athletes, have affiliations and histories with Perform Better. Won't be just limited to this program. Desert Willow Golf Resort, right here in Palm Desert, California. Get your tee times at desertwillow.com, home of the Mountain View and Firecliff courses, respectively. Don't forget about that summer VIP card. And I got to tell you what, I talked with Paul Busey. You remember Paul, recent guest of the Spicer Speaking Podcast, instructional guru. Talked to him about popping in a few times over these summer months. I think we're going to do an ongoing series of segments to that effect. Maybe set some goals, even. Certainly got to keep working on those mid-irons, even a few of the lofted irons. 8-9, pitching wedge, all been sloppy for me in recent months. Paul acquiesced. He's a good guy. He's like that. But he told me, hey, man, I'm still giving a lot of lessons in June. So, yeah, we're in the sizzle season. Still seeing a lot of people out there playing golf. No matter the heat, don't sweat that sizzle. Get out there. Just get out there early. Last but never least, Hennebree Photography, internationally renowned golf photography from John and Janine Hennebree. Johnny on the road right now, going to be away, taking pictures, seeing family, golf courses around the West Coast, if not beyond. But he'll be back. As I said, we just knocked out a project right before he left, that for the summer issue, to mention again the SCGA's 4 magazine. Certainly wish Johnny and his bride Linda well in their summer travels. That preface, friends, your U.S. Open special of the Spicer Speaking Podcast. Let's get to this week's guests. All right, friends. Big week on the Spicer Speaking Podcast. As prefaced, the U.S. Open special, the 121st playing just down the way, just 100 miles down the way at the Torrey Pines South Course
as the event and the championship returns there for the first time since 2008 to speak toward the championship. As mentioned, got a pair of great guests today. It's going to start with the gentleman aptly referred to as the Open Doctor over the past 30 plus years, about 35 years. No other active golf course architect has even come close to having the influence that Rees Jones has had on major championship golf, not to mention Ryder Cup golf as well. That list of championships and courses includes, but by no means limited to, his extensive work over the past two decades at the Torrey Pines South Course, starting in 2001, had a revisit in recent years to do some additional work, remodels, renovations, modifications of all these great championship courses. Here to talk about Torrey Pines in the U.S. Open, it's Rees Jones. Rees, active times, open week. I appreciate your time, sir.
Well, great to be with you.
I got to start a little self-serving before we delve into Torrey Pines, if you don't mind. I've had the pleasure and privilege of playing several of your designs over the years. We've got Andalusia out here in the California desert. In recent years, enjoyed playing Danzante Bay, deservedly recognized in its short time. I think it's a 2016 design of yours, but already recognized as one of the best courses in all of Mexico. But I got to go to this one, Rees. It was about 3 or 4 years back on Dufusky Island, South Carolina, the Hague Point Club. For me, having had the opportunity and, again, the privilege of playing courses all over the world, all over the country, this is a Spicer Top 10. For you, and I know they're all like your babies, but given the logistics and given the location of that course on a small island across the Calabogie Sound from Hilton Head, it's got to be one of the more unique projects that you've ever worked on, I gather. Would that be accurate?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was exciting. I looked at that property probably for 2 or 3 years before International Paper bought it and we built that golf course. And then they let me build the golf course on the land that I desperately wanted because it was such a spectacular site. And then it made the top 100 in the country. Made the top 100 on the world list. It really has been recognized over the years as being one of the great golf courses in the world. And I was just there on Wednesday.
Oh, wow.
With the members of the club and looking at doing a few refurbishments. So it's an ongoing project that I've truly loved being a part of.
I had opportunity to play twice, and I believe there are 29 holes is two of the tees on the name course there. You can approach from two different angles, and then there's the 9-hole Osprey course as well. So I think I played both twice, if memory serves. First time I played with my girlfriend, the lovely Eden. The second time it was just me and I think a family of deer. I don't know if that's a not uncommon experience just to be kind of out there by yourself in nature at that Hague Point Club.
Oh, yes. When I was there, I saw a lot of those honorary members on the course. And they're all over the place. And it really is. I mean, I think Hague Point right now has almost no real estate available, like 2 or 3 houses for sale. It used to be several more than that. It's partly because it's so close to the civilization of Hilton Head, yet you're isolated and you don't feel crowded. There's no traffic. There's no cars. I mean, the golf course just flows through this magnificent forest, gets the Calabogie Sound several times, plays 2 par 3s that go out to the sandbar, the 8th and the 17th. The 9th hole may be one of the great holes in the world, but the 14th hole, the par 5 that comes back out to the Calabogie Sound, was ranked by Golf Digest as one of the top 99 holes in the country.
Certainly going back through my own notes, I had a big circle around a couple of the holes that you just mentioned. To really paint that for the listeners, I mean, you take a little boat ride, at least that's how we got there from Hilton Head, little 15-minute boat ride. And Dufusky Island, such an interesting, unique cultural place with the Gullah Geechee backdrop. You've got the Hague Point Club there. I think there's only about 400 full-time residents on the island. For listeners that are readers, of course, the Pat Conroy memoir, The Water is Wide, I read that before I went there just to get a sense of the island. There's really the vibe of being out there. There's no other place I've experienced like that playing golf in the world, Reese.
I don't think there is. And I think that's when I visited this week. We went over that about how unique it is in the Strawn Mansion that we brought in. And I stayed at the Strawn Mansion. Pat Conroy, I believe, lived on Defusky Island for a while. And it's got a great history and great atmosphere. In the Strawn Mansion, they even have a Starbucks, even though you're isolated from the rest of the world. I got my chai tea latte in the morning.
We had opportunity to stay there as well. And kind of running joke between my girlfriend and myself, when we went there to have dinner at night, as listeners may gather, there's the people that are members of the Hague Point Club. They've done just fine for themselves. And they were kind of looking at me, not with any hairy eyeball or any cross eye, but decidedly younger than a lot of the other people dining. So I was like, I was the young tycoon, to borrow from the Fitzgerald title. Like, who do they think this dude is? This young guy that is out here staying at our place and staying in the mansion and playing the club. So I took on the guise of the young tycoon while we were there, Reese.
Well, you'd fit in right now because during the pandemic, all these houses sold to young families. And so the age, average age has dropped like 16 years this year. So I think you got to go back and you'll blend right in.
If I get invited back, let's just say that's an opportunity I would not miss. All right. I didn't want to take up the entirety of our chat here, talk about at Hague Point, but while opportunity existed, had to pick your brain on that one. But
you have a great eye because when people go to Hague Point, there's a recent group of Golf Week panelists that went there, and they were just stunned by what a great golf course it was. And I did a little video with them while they were there, and it was great to get their feedback.
Torrey Pines in the Open, Reese. A lengthy history, now two decades. You know, you mentioned Hague Point and going back there, and that's obviously a continuing relationship. I imagine that you have many of them with courses and clubs that you've worked with. But 20 years is a long time, especially for a course. I know Torrey Pines is a unique municipal public course. But do you have many relationships that go on 20 years with public golf courses?
With public golf courses or U.S. Open, Hazeltine and East Lake, which is the tour championship site, Land Athletic Club, Highlands Course, which is going to have the ladies tournament in a couple weeks, Belle Reve, Beth Page are the ones that are the most famous.
The work, of course, began extensive renovations of the William F. Bell design, basically a total overhaul of that work, but a revisit as well in more recent years, and the Farmers has been played there since you went back in 2019. But maybe you can talk about some of the work that you did. I think that more of the golf viewing nation, sporting viewing nation, we want to recognize what you've done in recent years for the Open rather than what we've seen at the Farmers.
Well, our first renovation, which was a complete redo in 2001, I'll go into that later, but the recent renovations were really done by the city with the funds that were generated from the golf operation, no tax revenue. They really refurbish all their golf facilities every 15 years. And so we had that opportunity to do that prior to this year's U.S. Open. And what we did, we lengthened the course by another 100 yards. We lengthened the 15th hole. We lengthened the 10th hole, which were the most significant tee changes. We put the tee on the fourth hole right to the ocean. So now you hit into the slope a little more. We widened that fairway so the ocean comes into play, shrunk the bunker at the green. On the 17th hole, we did the same thing. We took the tee to the left. We really narrowed the fairway so the canyon comes into play more. We added a big chipping area behind number 9. Number 10, we relocated all the bunkers and the landing areas. So now it's a much more difficult drive, and a difficult second shot is more of an 8 iron than a wedge. We rebunkered the landing area in the 13th hole, which is the great par five that comes downwind from the ocean after you have to suffer through 11 and 12. And we regrassed the entire surrounds of all the greens. We grassed the approaches. We rebuilt all the bunkers with a bunker liner, so the sand is much more consistent. I think the players are going to like it a lot because it's going to be in great shape as well as a great design.
Speaking of the players, harken back to what occurred at 2008. Maybe you'll agree with me on this, Reese. Maybe not. I got to think that prior to Phil Mickelson's recent accomplishment at the PGA, there has been, in the new millennium, no more talked about, revisited, celebrated major championship than what occurred at 2008 at Torrey Pines. That's got to make you feel pretty proud of the work that you've done there. And would you agree with that assessment? Do you think that's still?
Yes. I agree with that 100%. It is on TV all the time. And I hate to tell you, I like to watch it every single time. And I think the general public does too, because it was such an unbelievable final hole. And for Tiger to make that 12-foot putt and then the playoff, looked like Rocco was going to run away with that. And Tiger came back. And people forget that he was playing on a broken leg. And it was just riveting. The playoff, I don't think anybody went to work on Monday because everyone wanted to see what was going to happen with Rocco and Tiger. And I'm a friend of Rocco's. And he still looks at that time, even though he lost, as the highlight of his golfing life.
And I think that certainly plays a part in why we remember that. I mean, the storylines from Rocco, as you referenced, and the way he carried himself to Tiger Woods, and then the playoff, and so many people, myself included, taking that Monday off. I've gone back to watch not just that final round, but that Monday playoff, 19 holes, of course, like literally dozens of times, more so than I've ever gone back to watch any other golf tournament. I don't think I'm alone in that regard.
No, I think you're correct, and it is mentioned so often on the TV networks, and I get asked about it probably more than any of the Opens that I was involved with, including Bethpage.
To further refresh from 2008, Tiger and Rocco, for those who might not remember, they were the only players, of course, Reese, to finish the 72 holes in the red, both doing so at one under par. Given some of the recent renovations, given what you know or anticipate about the setup for the return to the Open to Torrey, you expect as much this week? Maybe just a couple players in the red or the field battling for par?
I expect much the same, because John Bodenhammer is now setting up the U.S. Open, much like the U.S. Open was set up for years. There'll be 27, 28-yard fairways. There'll be a primary cut, 7 yards, about an inch and a half, and then he's going to go into a 3.5-inch rough on 7 holes, or the final rough on several other holes, which is like 4 to 5 inches. So it's going to be a driving accuracy open, unlike Erin Hills or Chambers Bay or Pinehurst, where they really had much more latitude off the tee. So I think the rough is going to be a major factor, especially since the players are hitting it so far off the tee. When they hit it offline, it's going to go into that rough.
You mentioned some of the other championships, some of the other championship venues, some of the other personalities. I mean, it's pretty amazing, Reese, when looking at the courses that you've worked on for both U.S. Opens, PGA Championship, and, of course, the Ryder Cup venues as well. But so often, there's a few aberrations in there, but the winners of these particular events, it's a total all-star cast. I mean, we're going from Curtis Strange to a couple of Paint Stewart wins, a couple of Tiger Woods wins, a Phil Mickelson win, and then all the way up to more modern times with Brooks Koepka back in 2018 for Belle Reve and the work that you've done there. Why do you think that the winners, pound for pound, of these championships and the courses that you've worked on is basically an all-star Hall of Fame cast?
Well, that's you make a very good point. We're not really trying to determine a score. We're just trying to make it a great test so that we get a proper champion and the cream rises to the top. And I think my first U.S. Open at Brookline with Curtis Strange, the number one player in the world at that time, beating Nick Faldo in the playoff, set the stage for that. And Tiger winning several times, Beth Page and Torrey Pines, to bring up the most notable ones. It really is a significance in that I think great players win on great golf courses.
Just want to touch upon a few of the holes from a viewer's perspective and a couple of the more nuanced design elements therein. One phrase that I've heard used from you or at least your colleagues at your firm are greens within greens. Can you specify or speak toward that particular design element, Reese?
Well, the transition, there's transitions in the greens that separate portions of the greens from others. And that's what we did at Torrey, especially with the back of the greens at Torrey. We got elevated green positions there. They're harder to access in the air than the front hole locations. So what we reward a shot taken at the flag, and then we really make a shot that doesn't go for the flag harder to make par and possibly make a bogey. So that's why you have a green within a green with the contours of the green. And the green contours are a form of hazard, just like the bunker or water or rough. It's a hazard to some degree because if you hit the wrong part of the green on several of them holes at Torrey Pines, you're going to have a tough two putt. And that's why they're designed that way.
Let's conclude with some of those specific holes, I guess, for a listener that maybe is going to download the Spicer Speaking podcast, listen to this chat with Reese Jones on Saturday or Sunday, watch the leaders coming down the stretch. I mean, really, Reese, once the leaders start making the turn to 11, 12, 13, before they wrap it up, of course, at the par five home hole, but 11, 12, 13, some really strong holes going on there. I think that's going to have a big impact on the outcome. Do you agree with those thoughts? And if so, maybe you can detail what we're going to see on some of those holes.
Yes, that's Torrey Pines' Amen Corner. and we've made 10 a little more demanding. It used to be a pretty much a birdie opportunity. Now it still is, but you have to earn it a little more readily. 11 is a great par three. It's a narrow front portion. It widens in the back. For some reason, it's sort of it's a 225-yard par three. And so it's a long shot to a small position on that hole. And that green is missed a lot in the Farmers Insurance Open. And a lot of bogeys are made there. 12 has a tongue on the left of the green. It's bracketed by bunkers on both sides. We pushed the fairway bunker on the right, farther out on the right, and took the first one out because that was affecting just the average golfers at Torrey Pines. But that, again, is a very important green to come in from the right side, especially if the pin is back left. So those are two very challenging holes into the wind. They play longer than they measure. Then you come to 13, which is 615 yards from the back tee, downwind, so you can go for it. We re-bunkered that landing area, so you have to carry the left bunkers to get a chance to go for it in two. If they push the tee up, which John Bodenhammer said they'll do on a couple of days, then the bunkers on the right come into play more, and more players will have a chance to go for it. But there's a valley in front of that green, and we bracketed both sides of the approach of the green with bunkers. So if you miss it right or left, you've got a very difficult shot to the pin. And the down the middle of the green is easy because there's a valley. The two wings are a little more elevated. So if you're going for it in two, you'll probably come up the throat and go to the valley, but there's a bunker behind that. Tiger made a tremendous eagle on that hole in the 2008 U.S. Open from the back of the green to the front of the green, and that catapulted his trophy and his win.
I'll conclude with this one, Reese. For me, I guess, called a degree of schadenfreude in that, you know, from week to week on the PGA Tour, for most events, you know, we see him chasing 15 under par, 20 under par, sometimes even 25 under par for the week. In the Open, I like to watch the players suffer a little bit, and therein lies the schadenfreude. I mean, when an Open is played or PGA Championship on a course that you've worked on, does it make you feel happy? Does it make you feel proud when they're battling to achieve par?
Well, the club or the cities or the state of New York, they like it when the par is a standard of excellence. And that's what the U.S. Open has always been, having par being a standard of excellence. It's a little bit harder now because they're hitting it so much farther and they're so much more accurate with the high shots that hold on the greens. The Pro V1X golf ball has made that possible. So I think single digits under par is what the club likes to have. The pros and the tour, they've got 25 under par, 22 under par almost every week. I don't think that's quite as entertaining as watching the pros have to earn their scores a little more easily because, I mean, a little more difficultly because I think that's the way we play the game. So I think you're going to find with the John Bodenhammer setup, which he has had at Pebble Beach and at Winged Foot with the narrow fairways, the higher rough, I think you're going to find par as a real standard of excellence. And the winner is going to be single digits under par.
Now, speaking of that standard of excellence, what a pleasure to have Reese Jones on this episode of the Spicer Speaking Podcast. Reese, thank you so much for your time and helping us get prepped for the 121st playing of the U.S. Open, again taking place this week, just down the way at Torrey Pines South Course. Appreciate your time, sir.
My pleasure.
All right, friends, as prefaced, it's U.S. Open week, of course, and with that in mind, it's a big week. So we've got a big show. The tee sheet is full of great guests. Enjoy chatting with Reese Jones and very much looking forward to speaking with our second guest. She's a golf professional for 3 decades, PGA member for almost as long, fellow contributor to the SCGA Spore magazine. I know she writes for some other outlets as well. Successful public speaker. The resume continues. You probably recognize her surname. Welcome Tina Mickelson to the Spicer Speaking Podcast. Tina, thank you so much for joining. Big week ahead.
It is. It's a big week. Thank you for having me. I am looking forward to talking with you today.
Well, as offered, I want to start with your contributions to the SCGA's Four magazine. I know that we both have filled up the mantle a little bit. We both were awarded the last go-round of the ING Awards. I'm not sure where you keep yours award. I think yours was a first-place award. I don't know if mine was first place, but congratulate you on that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Congratulations to you as well.
Thank you. Certainly going to talk about the U.S. Open, talk about Torrey Pines, talk about your younger brother, Phil Mickelson. But I do want to start with what I've read from your work, which I think is all of it, for your 2 to maybe 3 year series of contributions to Four magazine. And I'll tell you what, Tina, is as a writer, when I see a golf professional's contributions to magazine, sometimes I shudder a little bit at the outset in that I don't want to be cruel. I'll just be honest that oftentimes the golf professionals are not the best writers. Sometimes they have other people obviously readily edit or go through their work. That is not the case in any way with yours. You have a definite voice to your work, and you've taken on a lot of interesting topics in your contributions to Four magazine, ranging from golf and gender bias, sharing personal experiences therein. Certainly talked about your well-known golf family, talked about your brother turning 50 years old. I think he's going to be 51 this week, as a matter of fact. And yep. Then in the most recent issue, I loved your article on going through your brother's 6 second place finishes in the U.S. Open and digging into the backstories for each one of those finishes and some of the personal experiences and interjections of what was going on in his life and your family's life during a lot of those events. What kind of feedback have you received? I guess I want to start with the golf and gender piece that you wrote in the not too distant past. I mean, that was an exceptional article. We don't see a lot of writing to that effect in that vein in the golf writing world. That one I thought was really potent. Did you get a lot of feedback from that one?
I really did. And I appreciate that. And thank you for bringing that up. The reason that I actually felt like I wanted to approach that topic was because I feel like from my fellow professionals, the PGA members and all those that I've worked with in the industry, I feel like there has been a lot of support and kind of a feeling like we're all on the same team. So I feel like the industry itself, people always ask me, how is it working in a male-dominated industry? And to be honest, it's neither here nor there. It's wonderful. And it's just not for me anyway. It's not a thing. I'm a golf professional, and so is this person, and that's how we view each other. The difficulty that I had was with the general public. And when I say difficulty, I don't mean that it was mean-spirited. I wasn't being diminished. If you can look past what is happening at the time and dig a little bit deeper, there's usually a good, innocent reason for whatever behavior it is that you don't necessarily like, whatever your feeling or emotion is that is sparked, that is negative. Catch yourself and dig deeper and say, why does this man not for one second think that I could be a golf professional just because I'm a woman? That's not personal. It's just kind of the way things have been. It's the way it's just going to be your first thought. And so if you can take some of the personal out of that and just realize, okay, this is a situation and I'm just going to act as a golf professional, not a female that is upset that he wouldn't know that I am a golf professional. Life just gets a lot easier, less heavy, and more fun. And I feel like you are respected a lot quicker. And you gain that respect when you don't react, because I'm confident in what I'm doing. I don't need that confidence to come from somebody else. Okay. Does that make sense?
It does. And in my own work, in my own writing, I'll be honest that pound for pound, most of the people that I interview in the golf profession, whether it be a director of golf, a general manager, a head superintendent, it's pretty much guys.
Yes.
So when an opportunity arises to source a head pro that is a woman, or even more rarely a head superintendent that is a woman, I leap at that opportunity personally. I'd like to get some different perspectives.
Right. And I feel like sometimes I see women trying to be equal or to get equal respect as men by trying to emulate men or trying to be more manly or masculine. You can be yourself and not have to kind of try to fill a certain role. Be yourself and understand what your talents are and what you bring to the table. And that's enough. I remember my dad told me one time, and this was one of the most potent pieces of advice he has shared with me. I was going out to the Golf Channel to do something on their instructional show, and I got nervous and I called my dad and I said, you know, Dad, I'm watching these other videos of these other golf professionals. I'm not a so-and-so. I'm not a Rick Smith. I'm not this person. And my dad said, well, that's a good thing because we already have one of them. And we already have one of them, but they haven't seen you yet. So you need to go on and do what you do in the way that you do it, not the way they do it. Don't use the same terminology. Just go do what you do, and that will be enough. And I never forgot that. And he was so right, because I used to think I had to be like this person in order to be successful. And the opposite is true. And it took a long time to really, really resonate with that.
Well, referencing your dad and going back to your work with the SCGA's 4 magazine, you reference your family with some regularity, including your dad, including your brother, Phil Mickelson, including your brother, his caddy, Tim Mickelson. It's interesting, Tina, in that folks either with famous parents or maybe a famous sibling, oftentimes people can be kind of sheepish. They shy away from it. They don't want to discuss their famous father or mother, sister or brother. But you have leaned into it in a very fun, conversational, and interactive way, both via these articles and on your Twitter account, which, by the way, is at Tina Mickelson. Is that a conscious decision? Is that something that you thought about, or is that just you and your nature?
To be honest, I have not thought about it whatsoever. It's and thankfully I haven't gotten myself in trouble yet. Knock on wood. I just respond because before social media, we used to have these conversations by text. So we have a family text chain, and if something happens, we'll send a family text out to each other, and then it's just constant back and forth, and it's hilarious. It's a lot of fun. And so I happened to see something on Twitter, and I can be very naive at times, and so I just thought, I'm responding to Phil. And I knew people would see it here or there, but it never dawned on me that so many people would necessarily not only see it, but actually read it and then actually share it. So it was basically just, you see something and you just kind of do a quick little response. I did that when he tweeted something about when he was in that, his hotel caught on fire that one morning, and my mom called me and was in a panic. Have you talked to your brothers this morning? Oh my gosh. And that was quite a morning. And so I tweeted to him, you can't send a tweet like that out before you talk to mom first. And then I went to work and I was teaching, and I came into the golf shop and they said, yeah, we saw your tweet on TV. And I said, what are you talking about? And that's when I realized people do see this and they do read it. And it doesn't make me want to participate on social media any more or less. And I'll just put out whatever it is that's going on. It doesn't necessarily have to be involving Phil. I had a test that my 8-year-old daughter brought home, and her answer to the question, how did the battle at Puebla end? And her answer was, not so good. And so I'll post things that happen in our family because I just feel like that's how I relate to other people. And I don't think too much about I just don't think too much about it. Obviously, look good over, make sure I'm not going to offend anyone. But it's really not a thought when I'm doing it at the time.
And to specify one of those, during your brother's historic recent win at Kiawah Island, you shared a text message from your mom on your Twitter account, which was hilarious. And for all the snark on Twitter and all the negativity, I think people got a lot of joy out of seeing that and talking about, I can't recall it verbatim, but I think your mom referenced your brother activating his well-known calves.
Yes, she, now my mom's also very funny. And so when this is a typical text that would go out between the family when something happens. And so she was joking, and we get very nervous. And so we share nervous text messages back and forth. And so her text was basically, you know, call your brother and tell him not to worry about activating those calves or hitting bombs. Just par. That's all we want. And she said, he's not going to listen to me because I'm his mother, but he'll listen to you. And so some people thought that she was serious, like she would actually think you could call him during a round on a Sunday. And she called me and she said, people think I was serious with that. And so that was her big takeaway, was she's like, I don't want people to think that I don't know better. And I said, Mom, don't worry about it. It's fine. But things like that, it's just, I think maybe because this is kind of what we're so used to, just watching him play ever since he was 8 years old. And so it's always been a family thing, and it's been something we've enjoyed, and we like having fun with it. And so, of course, she's going to text something like that. But we, again, forget that not everybody knows this and not everybody realizes this. So if it's going to make somebody laugh, then that's great, because we need more laughter these days.
I would agree with that entirely, Tina. I think the general public and those listening to the show, they probably have a pretty good sense of your brother Phil Mickelson's approach to golf and philosophy to golf. How does that differ from your philosophy to the game in general, or when teaching students? Are you guys like-minded, or do you see the game in a totally different way?
We see it in a totally different way. He is absolutely obsessed with the game and has been ever since he was 3 years old. I don't remember Phil without the game of golf and being obsessed. He would sleep with his golf clubs and his golf balls in his bed. He ran away from home at the age of 5 because my parents wouldn't take him to the golf course that day. It was, and basically running away at that age was just walking around the block until my mom met him on the sidewalk and said, it's time to come in. But it was just, he was so passionate about it, number one. Number two, it's his job and it's his way of making money. And so, and he loves it. On his days off, if there's anything he can do, he prefers to play golf. That doesn't mean he feels like he has to practice. It means he wants to play the game. And I've never met anybody who is so obsessed with the game. His passion is just something I've never seen, not only golf, but in anything for anyone. And so I think you really need to have that passion and drive in order to achieve what he has. Now, having said that, I enjoy playing golf because I get to spend 4 hours on the golf course with a lot of people I don't really have much in common with.
Yeah.
And some of my best friends, we have grown our relationship on the golf course over, you know, many years, many hours together, but we don't really have that much in common off the golf course. We do now. We do things together off the golf course, but that would have never happened had it not been for the game. And so when I teach, I try to bring that message to my students, because so many of my students have higher expectations than are reasonable. So they're not going to reach their goals because they don't have enough time to practice, or maybe quite honestly, they just don't have the talent. And when I say that, I mean, you know, friends of mine who have called me and said, will you come watch me hit balls on the range because I think I'm going to try to play on the PGA Tour. Yeah, that's not going to happen. So, but you can take that passion for the game and utilize it as a business tool in your job, or just play more golf, and whatever your relationship is with the game, make sure it's realistic. How many times have you seen somebody hit a shot and they get upset, and you're thinking, that's a good shot for you. You're not good enough to get that mad. And I think a lot of people would have a lot more fun on the golf course if they had more realistic expectations of themselves. So that's what I try to bring to my students. With Phil, he's in a completely different atmosphere than most everybody else. And so his approach is definitely very different.
Friends, you're tuning into the Spicer Speaking podcast. Tina Mickelson is my guest. Tina, as mentioned, Rhys Jones, my previous guest on this episode, of course, total remodel of the Torrey Pines South Course, which you grew up and your family grew up, as far as I understand, playing quite readily. Recent article from a couple days ago by Todd Leonard, who may have written about your brother or interviewed your brother more than anybody else. That came out in Golf Digest. And it talked about your brother's success at the Torrey Pines South Course previous to the total remodel, in which he won three times. And then his results since then. He references some of your brother's reactions and impressions to the Rhys Jones work. Don't think that your brother, Phil Mickelson, super fond of some of the modifications made to that course. He hasn't won since then. I believe he's got one runner-up finish. I mean, for you, having played that course a lot, what are your impressions on what used to be the South Course and what has been the South Course since 2001?
Well, I personally have enjoyed the remodel. I think it was done very well. And I see the difference. I mean, obviously, but I don't feel like the way I play the course and my approach is any different than before. It's different in the sense that I'm playing the golf holes a little differently, obviously, but I feel like it still has maintained the same character and the same feeling as you go out and play. Now, having said that, and in regards to what we were just talking about, Phil's mental approach and his perception is going to be very different because we view the game of golf in general in very different ways. So that change will impact him differently than it impacts me. But having said that, he's grown up on that golf course playing a lot of his major junior golf tournaments there, and he's practiced there, I mean, forever. And so you gain an advantage when you know a course so well. And now that it plays so differently, he doesn't have that advantage over the other players in the field now. And so that's obviously going to impact you. And you can't help but have it impact whether you see the changes as desirable or not. So I'm sure that plays just a little part in it. It could be a little bit of a sentimental thing. You know, you've grown up on this course and you can play it well and you know it like the back of your hand, and now it's different. So that changes things in and of itself, no matter what those changes are.
Tina, relating back again to your brother's historic win at Kiawah Island, becoming the oldest major winner ever. Is that win, I know it's still fresh, and I'm sure that you and yours are still abuzz, as is the golf and sporting world at large, from what your brother accomplished there. Has that win meant more, do you think, to your family than any other in your brother's Hall of Fame career?
I don't know that it's meant necessarily more, but it is, it really is, had an impact on all of us because he is older. He's 50 years old now, and he doesn't seem ready to be done. And so the fact that he was able to win a tournament and still be so competitive made us very happy for him, because this is something he's done his whole life. He has worked extremely hard to continue to be where he is, maintaining his physical fitness, and his recovery now takes longer. It's harder to play four rounds of good golf in a row. And so watching him work harder than ever was really satisfying to see him actually keep it together for four rounds, both mentally and physically, and achieve this. But to be honest, it was never really something that we thought about in terms of his age. And if the commentators didn't keep talking about it over and over, I don't know that it would have even been something we would have thought too much about. It was just nice to see Phil continue to do what Phil does or what he has done up until this point. So it was a big win, and it really, really meant a lot. But I'll tell you what, that 2004 Masters, that might have topped it. That was, you know, so I can't say it was the biggest, but it was big.
And I asked that question, I guess, as something of a seed planter to my next question, in that given what happened at Kiawah Island and now moving to Torrey Pines, I mean, the narratives are multiple and myriad. If that was a legendary win and a storybook win for the history it made, this has Leviathan proportions. We touched upon all the storylines, Tina. This is the U.S. Open, where your brother has finished runner-up a record six times. This is Torrey Pines, where your brother played junior golf. This is your hometown. And it just kind of sets the stage that if your brother is even sniffing the mix come the weekend, there's not even another storyline which rings close. I mean, I don't want to make you tense with that, like, big preface, but how are you and your family feeling about your brother and the opportunity that lays ahead this week at the 121st playing of the U.S. Open?
To be honest, it's not something, that whole commentary is not something any of us are thinking about.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be a great story, but like you said, it just makes everything a little more tense and makes you a little more nervous. The way I'm looking at this week is I want him to go out and have fun, number one. I know that sounds very trite, but at this point, I think it's really important that you continue to enjoy the game. If you're not enjoying it, then you're already, that's a two-stroke penalty right there in my mind. So I want him to go just have fun and continue to play good golf according to him. I want him to feel like he's playing well. The worst thing is to watch him miss a short putt on 18, knowing he's going to have to go home and sleep on that, and just knowing he's going to be tossing and turning. And I want him to feel satisfied and happy with his work on the course. And if he didn't play great, I want him to be able to go to the practice range afterwards and figure it out instead of battling for 4 days. So that's kind of all we're looking at. I want him to be able to continue to play well. He mentioned just before he went back to Kiawah that he had an epiphany on the range. We were at a family dinner, and he just kind of nonchalantly said, I figured something out today, and it's game changing, and I can't wait to get out there. He said, I'll tell you right now, I will win, or at least be in contention in the next 3 to 4 weeks. He said, that's how confident I am. And my brother, Tim, who caddies for him, said, I can attest to that. He's been playing the best golf I've seen in 2 years. That right there is what I want to continue. And if it does, he's going to have a real great chance at winning. But when you start worrying about what other players are doing and what you have to do to beat them, it becomes more difficult. So if he can go out and play his best golf, then he's got a really good chance. And then after Sunday, when that last putt goes in, then you can start thinking about the storyline. But until then, he's just looking at, you know what, I just want to go out and play well.
I'll ask you lastly, Tina, given your vast experience with the Torrey Pines South Course, given obviously the fact that vastly familiar with your brother, and given your vantage as a longtime golf professional, What's perhaps one aspect, or maybe even two, of your brother's game that you think that he's going to need to really execute and do well this week at Torrey Pines to contend?
Okay, that's a great question. I don't want to jinx anything.
Okay,
so I'm knocking on wood right now.
Okay.
But he has been keeping the driver and whatever club he's hitting off the tee in the fairway much better than usual. And so if he can put himself in a good spot off the tee, that is going to really help him. Obviously, his short game is going to be extremely helpful as well, because around the greens, it is no picnic. You have to be extremely, not only solid with your short game, but you have to be very creative with different shots. You can't just approach your chip shots around the green as you would normally. I know that the PGA Tour, that's pretty much a constant, you know, yeah, when you go to play these different events. But Torrey Pines has a knack for making anything around the green, it's almost sneaky difficult. It doesn't look that bad until you step over your ball and realize, oh, wow, yeah, this is not easy. So it almost lulls you into a false sense of security. And then you get over the ball and say, oh, wow. And so I think his short game for sure, the fact that he is also, even though the course is a little different, the fact that he's played there so much and is pretty comfortable with the conditions, I think is going to really help him. He won't be quite so intimidated when things are looking difficult. He can draw on his past experiences and say, I've done this before. I can do this today.
Tina Mickelson, so appreciative of your time for joining the Spice for Speaking podcast. We'll look forward to your work and upcoming issues of Four Magazine. Again, appreciate your impressions, both personal and professional, as we all ready for the 121st playing of the U.S. Open. Best to you, best to your brother, best to your family this week at Torrey Pines, Tina.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for episode 27 of the Spicer Speaking podcast. Thank you so much to my guests, only enhancing enthusiasm for what is to be this week at the 121st playing of the U.S. Open down the way, the Torrey Pines South Course, Rhys Jones and Tina Mickelson. I know we're all, many of us, if not most of us, all of us, curious to see what her little brother, Phil Mickelson, does, vying for his first U.S. Open crown. The show would not be possible without three excellent sponsors. Perform Better. Check them out for all your gym, fitness, workout, seminar needs at performbetter.com. Desert Willow Golf Resort. Tee times made at desertwillow.com for the Mountain View and Firecliff courses, respectively. Don't forget about that summer VIP card or the on-site Palm Desert Golf Academy. Still a lot of lessons going on. People getting better. I need to get better, too. Internationally renowned golf photography from John and Janine Hennebry. Can find their vast international portfolio, courses around the world, courses around the country to be sure, at the Hennebrys, H-E-N-E-B-R-Y-S, whether you're a golf course owner, operator, director of golf, head pro, GM, you're looking for some expert imagery of your course, give the Hennebrys a ring. Again, find them online at thehennebrys.com. Appreciate all your time, interest, appreciate your ears, friends. Thank you so much for tuning in to episode 27 of the Spicer Speaking podcast. Be good to one another out there. Enjoy the U.S. Open and be well.